Support for WPR comes from Viterbo University, offering online bachelor completion programs, including business, education, nursing, and more. Information is available at viterbo.edu/completion.
Support for WPR comes from the National Eagle Center in Wabasha, Minnesota, offering daily eagle programs, guided habitat tours, behind-the-scenes experiences, and more. Details at nationaleaglecenter.org.
Why on earth am I here right now? I keep asking this question. Still so far from Cape Horn, and yet I am in constant fear of what could happen tonight, tomorrow, or next week. In reality, I still have a month at the very least before I can sail north, out of the Southern Ocean, and into the relative safety of the South Atlantic. It seems like a month has passed in the last 24 hours with all that has happened.
When Jerome Rand decided to sail nonstop around the world in a 32-foot boat, he had plenty of questions remaining, including the biggest of all, why do it? Would he find the answer to that question when and if he completed the voyage? I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. We're going to follow Jerome Rand as he sets out from Gloucester, Massachusetts. First, welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you, Norman. It's a pleasure to be here. I appreciate the chance to chat with you.
I should mention that Jerome is the author of the book Sailing into Oblivion, the solo nonstop voyage of the mighty Sparrow. What inspired you after the experience to write the book? And did you need a little bit of downtime to absorb it all?
Yeah, I needed a little bit of time to reflect for sure. But I have to thank all the people around me that sort of followed the voyage. They were the ones that really goaded me into doing the book and preparing for it. Because it is, you know, as a first time writer, it is a pretty massive and intimidating thing to try and sit down and write 50, 60,000 words. But I had a great run in with a very good author, John U. Bacon, who wrote The Great Halifax Explosion, amongst many other books. And he gave me a bunch of tips what to do. But one of the big things was write the book sooner rather than later, because all those memories, they'll slowly start to dim. Now, I was lucky because I had the logbook, I had the journal entries, I had a lot of data from the trip that I could use as a resource. But for me, the biggest stumbling block was just trying to figure out a way that I could slice away the time, because he had said, you know, you want to dedicate a number of hours every single day from start to finish of that first draft. And then I came up with the idea, well, I got a boat, I've got the whole winter, might as well sail down to the Caribbean and spend it on anchor trying to write a book. And that was all it took, and I was off and running.
What made you think that the boat, and give us a description of it, was up to the voyage?
Well, believe it or not, if you're familiar with the book, The Perfect Storm, or the movie,
sure.
In reality, in the actual storm, the sailboat, if you remember, was a Westsail 32. Now, that's what Mighty Sparrow is. It's not the exact boat, but it's pretty much the same one. And in that story, even after the captain and crew were pulled off of that boat, Satori, that boat sailed itself through the rest of the perfect storm and beached on the Jersey shore, variably undamaged. And when I heard the account, the true account of that, I thought, okay, well, this is a boat that I got to at least start researching. And the more I poured into it, the more I realized that while these boats were built 50 years ago, they were built in a way that made them so strong and so capable for this type of journey, this type of voyage. That was primarily what I was looking for. And I had to look at, I don't know, 10, 15 different boats in person before I landed on Mighty Sparrow. But yeah, it's really a thing about, I wasn't worried about speed getting around the world. I was more worried about just reaching home.
What was the longest solo sail you had done before this 29,000-mile effort?
Actually, so the summer, essentially, before this trip, because I left in October, I spent training, and I had to actually learn how to solo sail on the ocean. I'd sailed plenty of times as a crew member, captain, mate, but I'd never done any solo ocean sailing. And so I headed down towards the Caribbean, and I think the longest one I did was 26 days, probably around 2,500 to 3,000 miles alone at sea.
And some boats are better than others at being sailed solo.
Yeah, some of them are set up for the distinct purpose of being able to control everything from the cockpit. And a lot of those are geared more towards racing and performance. Mighty Sparrow and a Westsail 32 harkens back to a different era of ocean sailing, pre-GPS, pre-technology, but at least, you know, well forward of the great age of sail, you know, 200 years ago. But at the same time, you know, most of the equipment on Mighty Sparrow is from that time. I still have a sextant, so I can take, you know, my position using the sun and the stars. I still write down my position on a paper chart. Obviously, I've added a few technical technological updates, but I try to keep to that sort of romantic ideal of, you know, the old time sailors learning how to do, you know, the first trip around the world solo without stopping was done in 68 and 69.
Sir Francis Chichester, yeah. Gypsy Moth, wasn't it?
No, that was a couple of years before, and he did one stop in Sydney, Australia, where he did a massive refit of the boat. It was Sir Robin Knox Johnson in 68 and 69 after, I believe it was 312 days at sea. And his boat, Suhaily, was very similar to Mighty Sparrow, except made out of teak.
Did you have an autopilot then?
So on my boat, it's an autopilot. It's what's called an Aries wind vane. And the nice part is it doesn't use electricity. It just uses what's called a servo pendulum gear, where essentially it's just a mechanical device that's 50, 60 years old. And it sits on the back and it basically keeps Mighty Sparrow on course. Especially comes in handy, obviously, when I'm down below asleep, because you can't just stop the boat. You got to keep going.
Before you left Gloucester, what did your grocery list look like?
Oh, man. I had been provisioning for months and months and months. I received so many Amazon boxes from, you know, everything from MREs, the meal ready to eat for the Army, to a lot of dehydrated Mountain House meals, and then box after box of canned fruit, canned vegetables. I had just about everything under the sun. I did, however, in the end, really came up short. And I don't want to give away too much from the book, but I end up rationing for quite some time on this voyage.
Same with water, too.
Yeah, water became quite an issue. You know, that was one thing where I had what's called a hand desalinator pump, and that allowed me to produce about a gallon of fresh water per hour if I sat there and just pumped away at this thing. Unfortunately, around the middle of the Indian Ocean, around 90 days into the trip, I was producing water, and after it made about 10 gallons, it exploded and way beyond repair. So I was at Mother Nature's whim for fresh water from that point forward.
How did you feel on day one, setting out from Gloucester, the open water, not completely empty? I assume there was some boat traffic out there at that point, but still, you're just shooting a straight line beyond sight. How did you feel on day one?
Day one was pretty exciting, definitely some jitters. I wasn't, you know, it all sort of happened so quick. You have all these months of preparation leading up to that point, and it's always very chaotic for the couple of days leading up to the actual departure. And there is an initial calm because it's just you and the boat and the horizon, and you kind of just get right into working and changing sails and heading out. But, you know, to be honest, there was, as I as the sight of land drifted away and I started thinking about the magnitude of the voyage to come, I started getting a little bit of fear, a little worry, a little anxiety that started to crop up. And I really had to battle against that and sort of manipulate the thinking going on in my brain to not want to go ahead and just turn around and say, what the heck did I get myself into?
What kind of communication did you have with Shore?
For that voyage, I had a satellite phone, but that was used primarily for downloading the weather files so that I could see the forecast for the coming days. And then I also utilized a Garmin inReach, and that allowed me through my phone to be able to text people anywhere on the planet anytime I wanted to. And that was really important, especially for friends and family, to do the daily updates so that they knew where I was and you know, how I was doing.
What was your first challenge where you began to think, should I really be out here?
Well, that came in the form of Tropical Storm Ophelia, about 10 or 12 days out into the voyage. And, you know, October, it's still part of the hurricane season. And that's what makes leaving for a journey like this from the United States an extra bit of difficult, because you have to cut across the hurricane path to get to where you're going, just to really cross the first ocean. And essentially, Hurricane Ophelia came up from the south. I had to avoid it, and so I headed south underneath it, let it pass in front of me. And while that wasn't too wild of a storm, I just caught the edge of it. It put me in a position where when I hit the easterly trade winds, I still had to get further east. And for the next, I don't know, before I got to the equator, I think I had easily 20-some days of bashing into the wind and waves. Boats heeled over at about 20 degrees. And when that goes on and on 24/7, it is absolutely draining to your morale, to your energy. It's very tough on the boat. And I would say that mentally, that was one of the most difficult parts of just getting, you know, cross that first little hurdle.
And I gather a lot of things just aren't where you left them when you put them someplace, constantly moving around down there.
Yeah, they eventually settle and find their happy home in many spots. But funny enough, you say that, the worst time is when you actually get totally becalmed, the wind dies off, and the waves stay. Because then you're getting rolled not just one way, but the opposite way as well. And sometimes it's so violent, that's when stuff just starts rolling and the noises, the cacophony of noise down below, and you're just stuck there and there's nothing you can do. That is another big mental challenge.
It seems a little paradoxical that when it's calm, when you are becalmed, that you actually take down your sails.
Yeah, I mean, there is. So if it's not too wavy and rolly, you can leave your mainsail up and it does what's called slatting. So it'll flop back and forth, but it kind of acts like a stabilizer in the air. The only drawback is that you've got this sort of slapping noise that happens every few seconds, and that becomes quite mind-numbing. But in the Southern Ocean, especially when the swell is so big, in between the storms, you get the calm, and I would have to take the mainsail completely down, and then you roll very, very heavily, but then you're protecting your equipment a little bit better.
What was the state of the water as you get down? Well, you're crossing the Gulf Stream, I gather, and then going south toward the equator. You're out there not seeing anything, I assume, for days at a time. What's the water look like?
It's pretty interesting, actually. So when you leave the East Coast, you know, the water's kind of green. There's a lot of algae in it. There's a lot of runoff and stuff. But after a few hundred miles, it starts to take on this brilliant kind of electric blue, just a bright, bright blue. And the further offshore you get, the clearer, more distinct that color really comes out. And it's one of those things where you don't really ever realize just how blue the ocean is until you're far, far from land. And although it, you know, changes shape as far as how the waves are breaking and the size of the swell and all that sort of stuff, that color is so vibrant. You almost feel like you're living inside of it once you're out there.
You see signs of humanity when you're out there, though?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you're going to pass a couple of ships here and there. There are some very busy shipping routes. But for the most part, in the open ocean, you can go weeks without seeing a single ship. In the northern hemisphere, you'll see the jets passing over. But in the southern hemisphere, once you get far enough south, the only thing you really start to see is at night you'll see satellites. There's no more airplanes. There's no more shipping traffic. It's just you, the stars, and every once in a while a satellite. That's about it.
What about pollution?
Well, yes. Unfortunately, that is something I witness pretty much all the time. I just came back from a 16-day trip in the North Atlantic, and I ran through some pretty heavy patches of floating plastics and debris. And when I was on this voyage, I actually sailed through the South Atlantic garbage patch, which, you know, it's not a collected like island by any means, but for about 500 miles, I could look around and count to at least 10 how many pieces of plastic I saw.
And for the bigger patches, I gather it's a matter of wind and current combining to swirl these things together.
Yeah, exactly, Norman. All of the oceans have, you know, a circular current, and so it sort of draws anything that's floating right into the center. And, you know, these things slowly do break down, and the fish eat them and all that sort of stuff. But in the center of these oceans is where you find these areas.
There's one social change that you mention in your book from, oh, let's say 20 years previously, something like that, having to do with communicating with other ships, with other vessels.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of interesting, and it harkens to that idea that, you know, technology that's supposed to bring us together and make it more convenient for us to communicate seemingly does the opposite, and people feel more isolated. And out on the ocean, back when I first started ocean sailing back in the early 2000s even, you know, if you saw a ship, the first thing you did was call them on the radio. They'd answer you back. You'd have a little bit of a chat, and then you'd go on with your day. It was kind of like a bit of a cordial greeting out at sea. And nowadays, it is very rare for me to get an answer on the radio from any passing ships, unless there's, you know, a collision that might happen or something like that. And I don't know, it's kind of, you know, gone are the days of ships greeting each other with respect, you know, as they pass on the open ocean.
Maybe swapping groceries and that kind of thing.
Yeah. Hey, do you guys have an extra bottle of something up there? You know, leave it in the water.
It sounds as if actually the whales were more communicating than the other ships.
Well, and that's a double-edged sword for me, because it's obviously exciting and amazing when the whales come in and get very curious. But when the whale is bigger than your boat and it is within mere feet, just swimming right alongside, you realize, you know, just the absolute massive scale of these things. And they move very nimbly, but boy, you think, holy cow, one false swipe with that giant tail, and all of a sudden my Aries wind vane might be broken, or my rudder or something. Or, you know, heaven forbid, you somehow tick the whale off, and all of a sudden he decides, well, we're gonna bump into this guy. Because unfortunately, I'm pretty well versed in quite a few tragedies when it comes to whales encountering boats and them smashing into each other. And tell you the truth, it's one of my biggest fears out there.
We're going to look further at the round-the-world sailing trip of my guest, Jerome Rand, when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Jerome Rand, the author of Sailing into Oblivion, the solo nonstop voyage of the mighty Sparrow. There are five major landmarks that you talk about in your book, Jerome, the five capes. And what are they at the top? And then we'll pass by each one in one way or the other.
All right, sounds good. Well, essentially, yeah, down in the Southern Ocean, the five stormy capes are what you have to get around to be able to circle the globe, essentially. And it's the only route you can do this without actually having to stop, like at the Panama Canal or the Suez. Now, the traditional route is a west to east rounding of Antarctica. And essentially, when you're leaving from the United States or the North Atlantic, you're going to go down across the equator. And the first one that you come to is the Cape of Good Hope, which lies at the southern tip of Africa. Then across the Indian Ocean, the first one is the western southern edge of Australia, and that's Cape Leeuwin. Then you pass under Tasmania, that's the third. You've got New Zealand, that's the fourth, but the mother of them all is Cape Horn at the southern edge of South America. And that one really is notable because it's so far south. It lies at about 56 degrees south latitude.
There's really just a strait, isn't there, between the Palmer Peninsula of Antarctica and Cape Horn. It's a fairly narrow passage.
Yeah, it's Drake's Passage, and it's about 500 miles in between. So if you're going to see icebergs and if you're going to see some serious weather, that is definitely one of the spots. But they all have their own very distinct sort of problems, good and bad on all sides. You know, Cape Horn is so far south, but you can round it, and then you're in the lee of that land. But you look at the Cape of Good Hope, and the Cape of Good Hope has a whole different can of worms. It has this very strong Agulhas current that's running right alongside of it. It's also a 600-mile stretch, so you're down that far south for quite some time trying to get around. And so each one has its own characteristics.
As I guess do each of the oceans, and most notoriously, apparently, the Southern Ocean.
Yeah, I mean, the Southern Ocean as a whole is, it's almost hard to describe, but I would say a no man's land is about the best way. Essentially, marching on the perimeter of Antarctica is an endless parade of gales and storms called Southern Ocean lows. So think of a mini hurricane, but one after another after another. Now, you got to mix in the freezing temperatures, snow and sleet. Then you've got foggy days and the odd iceberg that floats up from the coast. Now, icebergs, half the time, you're not even going to see them. We call them growlers. And these are, you know, the size of a truck or a car, and they're just floating underneath the surface. If it's foggy out, you wouldn't see it anyway. And or if it's at nighttime, your boat slams into one of those, you're almost guaranteed to go down. So all these sort of things play on your mind. But one of the biggest, most challenging aspects, especially mentally, is the isolation. Because in the Southern Ocean, there's just nobody down there. You're far, far from rescue. You know, if something did happen and you ended up in your life raft, you might be lucky to get rescued within a week, which in those temperatures, chances are hypothermia is going to take you a lot sooner. In the South Pacific portion of the Southern Ocean, you actually pass a place called Point Nemo.
Yes.
Point Nemo is the farthest you can get from land. I believe it's 1,600-mile radius around that area, which equates to about 8.8 million square miles of empty ocean. And they say the only time somebody else is near you when you're in that position, they're aboard the International Space Station, 200 miles overhead.
It's hard to believe, isn't it, that you'd be closer to somebody in outer space than you would to the next person on Earth. But I think you also did find, just to skip out a little bit, a plastic bottle nearby, didn't you?
I did. That was a heartbreaking sort of sight. You know, you kind of think, well, there's got to be places on the world that haven't, where you can get far enough away where there's no trace of man. But unfortunately, that was the reality. And that was when it really hit home that there's no place in our oceans that haven't been affected by that.
You had some knockdowns?
Yes, I've been knocked down quite a few times, but old Mighty Sparrow keeps getting up to fight another day. The first one was in the Indian Ocean, and that was on the edge of Tropical Cyclone Irving, which kind of chased me around a little bit. And I kind of made the rookie mistake a little bit of crossing in front of the cyclone, which is never a good idea. But down in the Southern Ocean, it's a race to get to Cape Horn. So you kind of just have to put the throttle down and go for it. But essentially, a knockdown in basic terms is when a very large wave or a very strong wind hits the boat with such brunt force that the boat then does it flips 90 degrees onto its side. The mast hits the water. It's a very, very scary situation. The impact alone, the noise that comes from that, I can only equate it to like a car accident. It's very, very loud. It's very jarring. Luckily, a boat like Mighty Sparrow is built to be able to handle a number of those impacts. And she did pretty well in the first one. The second one, we had a little damage. But later on in 2022, I was hit by a very large rogue wave, turned upside down, and we did extensive damage in the North Atlantic on another voyage. So, you know, those waves have a lot of power in them.
Was there a point in the Southern Ocean where you seriously thought, if I could, I would get off now?
Oh, gosh, yeah, of course. I mean, you know, you got to picture yourself, Norman. You're sitting at the nav station. It's like 25 degrees outside. Maybe it's snowing or it's rain. I don't know. It's terrible. And you're looking at this chart. And just north of your position, you know, maybe a week away if you started sailing right now, lies Tahiti or Fiji, these just beautiful places. And you think, boy, you know, I've got a couple MREs to eat, or I could head up there and maybe have some fresh coconuts. And your mind is trying to get you to go the easy route all the time. And you have to keep battling against that.
Well, how did you keep mentally healthy? It sounds as if you talked to yourself a lot, or talked to the boat, or even one or two of the devices on the boat.
Oh yeah, full conversations were had between myself, Mighty Sparrow, and Mongo. That's the nickname of the Aries wind vane, because sometimes Mongo likes to misbehave or not do exactly what I want. You know, I think it would have been far stranger to not say a single word for 271 days rather than, you know, have these conversations while I'm out there. And I think that kind of shows that I'm a normal, level-headed person. But as far as keeping that stasis going, really having the routines in place, keeping yourself busy. I've read a lot. I listen to a lot of audiobooks and podcasts and things. But I also, you know, you really just had to take a moment every now and again and do a little self-evaluation of how you're feeling, how you're doing. And, you know, sometimes it's out loud, sometimes it's internal, but just to kind of keep an eye on things, because the threat of going crazy out at sea is very real. There's plenty of stories where it happens. And, you know, luckily, I think my head stays in the game when I'm out there, which is pretty nice.
Well, not just the solitude, but in your case and in many other cases before you, I would think you combine that solitude with dwindling nutrition as you put yourself on rations, and physically and mentally you're changing.
Oh, yeah. Well, and, you know, they have that saying, the adventure truly begins when things stop going according to plan. And, you know, in some
ways. It's a positive way to look at it.
It was, well, you know, that. What else are you going to do, right? I mean, after the water pump broke, it was another couple of months before I realized the food was starting to dwindle.
What was the food that you most missed out there? What kind of food fantasies did you have?
Oh, man, don't even get me started. I thought about pizza and, you know, all the good stuff. But even things like a fresh garden salad, you know, fresh fruit. I think, though, my favorite food out there is breakfast. I love cooking up these big, you know, omelets and breakfast burritos and bacon and all this sort of stuff. And man, that stuff went the way of the dodo way back, just across the equator, I think. And, you know, it's one of those things, you can't keep that stuff fresh for long enough, but I dreamt about those. But the first meal that I think brought me to tears when I returned to land was a bite of a pepperoni pizza.
It occurs to me that, and maybe it's just a stretched metaphor on my part, but you encounter a lot of doldrums along the way in this trip, and these doldrums then, which of course can be pretty depressing for a sailor, calm and relaxing as they might be for the first few minutes after a couple of days, are pretty dreary stuff. But then out of nowhere, like you're going from, you know, zero to 30 or 40 mile an hour wind, and it seems as if at times your mood reacted the same way with the same extremes from depressed to euphoric almost.
Oh, yeah. I have always described life at sea, at least mentally, as an emotional roller coaster. And it is 100% dictated by what Mother Nature is throwing at you at the moment and how the boat is basically reacting to it. And yeah, I mean, you go through those extremes of the intensity and the power you're witnessing in a gale, and you're nervous and you're like, oh, is she going to hold? Is she going to hold? And then it starts to break. There's this relief. But then as the winds really start to trickle out and then they become fickle and non-existent, then you know you're just stuck again. And so that plays in your head and you're thinking, I'm not making any progress. It's super uncomfortable. And, you know, you're riding these highs and lows. And so rarely do you ever find those perfect conditions. But what I found very important was that when you did find them, you needed to make sure you relish that time and you save it and you keep your eye knowing that, okay, now the times are tough again, but we're going to get back to that spot. So it's going to be worth it. I have to keep pushing through.
Did you ever take a day off?
The closest thing to a day off I had on this voyage was when I got to go and sail down towards the Snares. And essentially the Snares lie about 100 miles or so south of New Zealand. And you have to cut across, you kind of have to thread the needle a little bit to get into the Pacific Ocean. And essentially, as I'm crossing this shallow spot, the winds come from the east, right where I want to go. And I know I'm not going to make any headway into the Pacific that day. And so I decided, you know what, the Snares are half a day sail that way. So I turned my boat and I headed down there because I hadn't seen land at that point since way back in the South Atlantic, maybe 4 months prior. And boy, I got to tell you, one of my favorite things out at sea is spending literally months looking at nothing but an empty horizon and the clouds, and then to see almost like a sunrise, but a hillside green or, you know, dark off in the distance start to rise out of the sea. And as you get closer, you smell the earth, or in the case of the Snares, it smelled like birds. It's just an amazing sight to see land after such a long time of taking in only the blue of the sea and the blue of the sky. Then all of a sudden you get the brown and the green of earth, and it truly is amazing.
Speaking of birds, you did have an encounter with an albatross, and anybody who's ever read The Rime of the Ancient Mariner, or I suppose any number of other things, knows about the superstition, if you want to call it that, about albatrosses.
Yeah, it's one of the most, if you ever want to have almost guaranteed bad luck, you kill an albatross. And, you know, unfortunately, in my situation down there, it was definitely not an intentional sort of thing. It was, you know, one in a million sort of situation, but desperately trying to fish and catch food, I was over a portion of the ocean called the Campbell Plateau, where, you know, shallower waters, you're going to find a whole lot more fish. And unfortunately, there were a lot of birds there, and one of these albatross got the lure hooked into its beak. And, you know, I'll save the audience from a description, but I can tell you I broke down, and it was one of the worst days on the whole voyage for sure.
Do you think it brought you bad luck?
You know, all evidence to the contrary. I made it back.
Well, there is that.
I made it back in one piece, so that helped. But, you know, I think if there's some sort of universal order out there, I think essentially whoever's in control of it realized that it was an accident. It wasn't anything intentional. And so I think my place in the universe is still secure.
We're going to look at that most notorious of waypoints, Cape Horn, when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Jerome Rand. He is the author of Sailing into Oblivion, the solo nonstop voyage of the mighty Sparrow. You have mentioned these five capes that were particularly notorious points of passage, each with a characteristic and a challenge all of its own. But most notorious of all, down there at the tip of South America, is Cape Horn. How did you approach that? What were your thoughts, and how did it go?
Well, it's mostly fear, I'm not going to lie. You hear the stories. The nickname of Cape Horn is the graveyard of the ocean, and it's aptly named because when you do sail down there, you're sailing over the top of 1,000 shipwrecks, and it really can be quite a haunting place. I think any sailor that makes their way that far south, they're all going to be affected in some way by that knowledge, but it's a really difficult spot to reach. You know, as you cross the Southern Ocean from New Zealand to South America, you're usually around 45 degrees south latitude in a place called, they call that the Roaring Forties because of the winds. Well, you have to go down to 56 degrees south latitude in an area called the Furious Fifties. And I was told before I left by a few people who had sailed there that once you cross that 50 degree latitude line, everything will change. It's just going to get worse. And I kind of thought, yeah, you know, whatever. It's just an imaginary line. Well, they were 100% right. The temperature dropped. It stopped raining. It was only snowing after that point. The calms and the storms were far more severe. And it just had this ominous feeling. The ocean seemed to even change to a darker color down there. And you could really just feel that you were in a place that you really didn't quite belong. And so as you make your route change to go further and further south, there's a commitment that essentially as you approach South America, you are now producing what's called a lee shore. So the winds and the currents, everything's pushing you to the shore. So if you get into trouble, you no longer have this big expanse of open ocean. You've actually got a big impediment in your way. So the minute you dip down, you're 100% committed to it, and you just have to basically deal with whatever the world throws at you. And even though the actual rounding of Cape Horn is done pretty much in a day, the approach and then getting north out of those deep south areas, essentially that's going to take you 10 days, 14 days to do the whole proper rounding where you get out of the Southern Ocean. And, you know, that length of time under that sort of pressure and fear is very difficult to handle. The only thing that I think on a trip like mine that helps is the fact that you had been sailing for 6 months previously, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And if you think about it, that's a heck of a lot of practice for the big game of getting around Cape Horn.
I gather the Strait of Magellan is even worse.
You know, I've often pondered a trip to go down there and do that. I feel like it would be very interesting. You know, an ocean sailor, the biggest fear is running into the land. And yeah, I mean, to get through the straits, you've got a huge amount of navigation, and the winds I have heard are absolutely unpredictable, ferocious, because they're rolling through all those valleys and mountains down there. But also I've heard it's one of the most spectacular places to sail if you can put up with the weather.
You had an engine. How much did you use it?
The game plan with the engine was to never use it for propulsion, only to utilize it essentially to charge the batteries if needed. But I had solar panels on board, and that took care of it for the most part. Typically, I tried to run the engine once every 10 days to 2 weeks, and that was mostly just to, you know, extend the life of it. If an engine sits for too long and, you know, is getting splashed with salt water and all that sort of stuff, it starts to fall apart. So you got to run it while you can. Unfortunately, I didn't watch my fuel levels all that well, and somewhere along the lines in the South Atlantic Ocean, I fired her up for the last time as the fuel ran out. And then the last, you know, 6,000 miles of the voyage were basically engineless.
You do have a sort of a credo when it comes to fixing stuff, and it seems to be a popular one among various people who have to fix a lot of stuff, and that is look for the simplest solution first before getting, in, you know, hands and over head over heels into fixing something.
If only I could abide by that in all walks of life, I tell you, it would be fantastic. But yes, you're always trying to start with the easy and work your way up to the hard. The other thing that I found really helpful, especially when you're in a situation where you're dealing with a very limited supply of spare parts or even miscellaneous equipment that you can then, you know, manufacture what you need, is that you really want to make sure when you come up with a plan to have a sit and have a long think about exactly what you're about to do before you drill a hole, before you cut something. And that way you can just really have a better chance of making sure it's a success right from the get-go.
And I suppose keep track of what you did so you can undo it when necessary.
I have done that plenty of times. And that's, you know, that's one of the benefits of the ship's log out there, where every 6 hours I am entering in all the pertinent data about what the weather and what the boat's doing, but also a couple of lines as far as anything else that's going on board the boat. And yeah, there's been plenty of times where I've had to look back in the log and say, when did I change that? Or what did I do that? And I like to try and be as descriptive as possible in there.
Well, having rounded those five notorious capes, most notoriously Cape Horn, you must have felt that you kind of earned some favorite sailing conditions. What would those be?
Those would be the trade winds. And you do. You have to fight your way north after Cape Horn for quite some time to reach the southeast trade winds. But when you do, and I still don't know exactly how to put words to this, but it is one of the greatest feelings I have ever felt in my life, when you finally left the Southern Ocean behind you, the warm trades fill in, and everything's steady and smooth, and all the fears and all the anxieties of the past like 6 months are just gone. And essentially, you are returning to this wonderful ocean world that is no longer threatening to kill you at every turn, but actually welcoming you in, and there's dolphins and the stars are beautiful. And it's one of those things where what truly makes it beautiful and above all else is the fact that you had to go through such a difficult path to get there. And that was one of the greatest lessons that I took away from this voyage, was, you know, the suffering and the bad times are just as essential in life as the good times. And that goes across the board, not just sailing or adventuring. In real life, you know, everybody wants to try and suffer as little as possible. But in some ways, you know, that suffering is what makes the joy so joyful, and it amplifies it. And there's no better teacher of that than the ocean.
What were your thoughts then once you started heading north on this pleasant sail? Was it really just kind of a romp for the rest of it, getting back to Massachusetts?
A lot of it was. You know, I had planned to do a flyby of a couple of islands in the Caribbean, so I knew I'd at least be able to talk to people and say hello, which was a big moment to look forward to. But yeah, it's kind of interesting, because once you get out of the Southern Ocean and that relief comes, give that about a week or two, and now all of a sudden you're still facing down another month to 2 months of sailing, and the voyage has now transitioned from this physical survival and the preparation of getting to the Southern Ocean, making it through, to now this kind of mental game of you've been out at sea now for 200 days and your brain and everything is completely been rewired. Can you make it another 60 days to get all the way home? And that's the sort of that's the new challenge, if you will, of that voyage, because, you know, along the way in the Atlantic, there's a lot of places you can stop, and you've sailed so far that you sort of, your brain keeps saying, well, you've gone far enough. Why don't you just stop here, pal? And you have to fight it and fight it and fight it.
You did have, a couple of food drops along the way, but you never stopped. You were always at sea.
Right, exactly. Yeah, the Falkland Islands, what we were able to do, my father got in touch with the Falkland Island government, and essentially they were like, yeah, listen, if he doesn't want to stop, we won't make him anchor and clear customs like you normally would have to. They were like, if you pay for it, we'll basically load a boat up with some food boxes, and we'll come out and meet you out in the bay area out there. So I had to sail in pretty close to land. But once I got in there, they basically pulled up next to me. We didn't even tie off or anything. And they basically chucked all these boxes of food straight over. And that was one of the most stressful days, but it was also one of the most rewarding days when I ripped into, I think it was like a turkey or a ham sandwich that I made, and these logs of chocolate chip cookies. I mean, I had been just on a starvation diet, essentially, of rice and lentils for so long that I had lost, I estimated, about 45 pounds. And I didn't have 45 pounds really to lose. And, you know, unfortunately, I didn't realize it was going on, because you never strip all your clothes off when you're down in the Southern Ocean. You just kind of hold on tight and you keep layering up. But when I did get a chance to take my first little bath, so to speak, north of the Falklands, and I saw the condition of my body, I was pretty much emaciated at that point. And so that food drop was really, it was essential. I didn't want to have to do it, but I knew that of all the goals that I had set forth, if there was one that I was going to break, it would be receiving assistance in that form.
After all of those difficulties, knockdowns and gales and all kinds of hazards, as you approach Gloucester, what was the sea like?
The sea wasn't too bad, actually. The last section from the Caribbean all the way up was rather benign. You know, June and July are very calm months in the Atlantic. The one trouble I did have was as I approached the continental shelf, the fishing fleets and the scallop boats, they are in mass out there and they're working. They don't care if somebody's sailed around the world or anything. You don't want to get in their way, and they're not on their radios. They're essentially just doing their thing. And, you know, I was pretty well used to being out at sea, but it was a lonely sea. It was my ocean. And now all of a sudden I'm sort of sharing it and I have to stay on my toes. And so I was a little sleep deprived by the time I got into the area around Gloucester. But that's when it got pretty interesting, because, you know, not only are you seeing all these boats, but you're seeing all the traffic from Logan Airport, and now all of a sudden your cell phone works, and now you know that there's all these people around. And as much as I wanted to just be on shore, I was also hesitating a bit, because you're about to immerse yourself. You're half crazed from being alone. You've got a big scraggly beard. But it was kind of, I don't know if it was Mother Nature's way of giving me an extra pause, but I essentially ended up about 5 miles or so outside of Gloucester, and the winds completely died. And I sat and I had to float there for an entire extra night.
A little anticlimax, maybe?
Well, in some ways, but I kind of think it was a bit of a reprieve because it gave me a chance to talk to a lot of people because my cell phone worked, but also kind of ease my entry back into the world. And I don't know, I think about that night every once in a while as a pretty happy time, even though everybody I knew was just a mere few miles away.
Well, let's circle back to where we began, and that is, why did you do it?
Ah, yes, the ultimate question. People have been asking me that forever. You know, my biggest, I think the biggest question that I had on my mind was this curiosity, not only if I could do it, but what would happen to me if I tried to do that trip? And by that, I mean both physically and mentally. What changes would I go through being out at sea by myself for that long? You know, I had essentially been inspired by these books of Sir Robin Knox Johnson, Bernard Mortissier. They were on every yacht that I ever hopped on to do yacht deliveries back in my early 20s. And after reading them enough, you know, and these guys were the ones that were the first ones to do this. And before them, in the late 60s, it was thought of as the impossible thing to do. You know, they didn't think a boat could survive out on the ocean for that long, a small boat. And they didn't think a human could mentally take on that much isolation and solitude for an extended period of time. And then these guys prove them wrong. And for me, I don't know, as someone who loves sailing and enjoys being out on the ocean, the idea of taking it to the extreme, and, you know, we live on this round earth, and to be able to sail from one place all the way around it and back without setting foot or popping an anchor down anywhere, it just seemed like such an over-the-top challenge. But as a sailor, it struck me to the core, and it was like a burning desire that I had inside of me that I just had to see what it was like. I didn't have any misconceptions about how dangerous it was and how my chances were very, very minuscule. You know, normally you'll have equipment failure, or, you know, you won't be enjoying your time, or something will happen, or you'll hurt yourself. And the vast majority of these voyages end up not being successful. So I knew that that could possibly happen. But for me, it really was, in one word, it was curiosity. I just wanted to see, I had to see what it was like to attempt to sail alone and without stopping around the world.
Did you have a kind of separation depression after the end of this trip around the world?
Oh, absolutely. I go through what I call post-adventure depression pretty much every time I get back from a large voyage, whether it's hiking to Mount Katahdin from Georgia or if it's sailing from Gloucester around the world back to Gloucester. You have this sort of thing and this purpose in your life that just drives you. It's the reason you get up. It's the reason you work hard. You know, eventually it kind of wears off a little bit and you get back to sort of a normal feel. But I think for some of us, and I know quite a few other adventurers of different ilk that do mountain climbing and all sorts of other stuff. And it seems to me that there's a few of us that no matter what, as soon as we finish one, we're already searching for the next adventure.
Well, good luck with that next adventure. Jerome Rand, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Norman. This has been great, and I look forward to seeing you in Madison in a few days.
Jerome Rand is the author of Sailing into Oblivion, the solo nonstop voyage of the mighty Sparrow. I'm Norman Gilliland. Our engineer is Lee Rayburn, and this is University of the Air.